and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. Today we're talking by telephone with Thomas Warger, a leading academic computing consultant who has held a variety of leadership positions in IT management and higher education, starting with 9 years as chief information officer at Bryn Mawr and including a stint as a consultant and interim computing director here at Vassar that I remember well. He's also the lead author of the EduTech Report, and Tom also has a doctorate in French studies from Brown University and has taught at Gettysburg and Union Colleges. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Tom. It's wonderful to be here talking with you on this show.
Yeah, it's really great to have you. So I guess I'll start by asking, you know, I know you've been deeply involved in academic computing development at liberal arts colleges for many years now, both as a consultant and as a chief information officer. And I wonder, are colleges and universities today confronted by differing kinds of problems and priorities now than they have been over the course of your career? I suppose the answer is yes, but, you know, I'm sort of wondering how things have changed. And I'm wondering if there are things that haven't changed.
Well, I think as you've suggested and how you framed the question, it couldn't be answered either way. And so, in fact, I'm going to answer it both ways.
Okay, great.
There are a lot of fundamental things that have not changed at all, except maybe in their local expression per campus or as they've varied a little bit with details over time.
Yeah.
But I think the basic questions, particularly for liberal arts colleges, who themselves have not changed radically over the time that computing has been around, I think that those questions are basically the same. And they have to do with what really happens when human beings take up the tools, their own tools, humanly produced tools of technology. How does that change what we do? What does it take in the way of skills, aptitudes, and patience, and support to do these things? I think these are perennial questions, and I think they're essentially the same questions over time. There are also questions about resources. How much money? How many people? How much time? Time being, I think, as a colleague told me many years ago, time is pretty much the currency of academic life.
Yeah.
We all have time to work with, and we all have to decide what we're going to do with that time. And so that is a perennial question also when we look at technology. I think a third unchanging question is, how do we come to be comfortable with and work effectively with the fact that technology is changing all the time? The only constant, you know, is change.
Yeah, sure.
It's changing at a rate that is very, very hard to keep up with. You know, for people in the IT profession, they very early have to get used to that idea that what you think you know today is already moving. And these things haven't changed. What I think is different today are, again, just to list several of the considerations, are that IT has been around long enough and has settled in deeply enough into campus life that it no longer has the kind of special status that it once had.
Uh-huh.
And so now it's being asked many of the same tough questions that the institutions are asking about other aspects of what they do. So, you know, do we really need all the staff that we've got in IT? That question gets asked whether a campus has a generous IT staffing level or a subpar level. The question still comes back, you know, can't we cut in IT also? Can't we cut those budgets the way we cut other budgets? Can't we reduce the personnel count the way we do elsewhere? So I think that's a change. And given the recession of the recent years, that's been, you know, freshly brought to the fore.
It's true also, isn't it, that computing departments and academic computing operations are being looked to help with the financial crisis at academic institutions generally.
And that, too, is new, I think.
Yeah.
I think the presumption always was that IT didn't have anything transformative to offer. Again, I'm talking about the context of liberal arts colleges.
Sure.
And that IT was a service to the traditional pedagogies and ways of conducting life on campus. But I think you're right. In now, boards of trustees, senior administrators are saying, let's take a different look at IT and see whether it can help us with some of these very big problems that we've got.
And that kind of research and development requires funding, doesn't it? I mean, you can't be cutting back on computing
right.
at the same time that you're trying to right. use computing to cut back on everything else.
Yeah, that's true. But I think what outweighs that, you know, very obvious and very important irony or discrepancy, problem, dilemma, you want more from IT and you also want to put fewer resources into it. I think just the fact that the question is being asked is a first-time opportunity to really get the right alignment between how important is IT and how does that connect to, you know, life and death issues for the institutions,
yeah.
or, you know, recruitment and retention, for example. So I think from the IT side, I can't speak for all my colleagues, and of course it's easier for me as a consultant who doesn't carry around the day-to-day responsibility
yeah.
of making a campus system work.
Yeah.
But I think we should be welcoming the focus, because it will give a good framework and a good context that's always been missing for
yeah.
senior administrators to really think about IT, not just as, oh yes, one more thing or something that's on top of all the rest we do, but how does it get factored into, you know, how we conceive of what a college or university is
yeah.
and, you know, think a little more rationally about how much we have to put into it.
Yeah, the catchword anymore, it seems to be in computing circles, analytics. And does this
mm-hmm.
have to do with
yeah.
what you're talking about here? Just to
yeah, very much. In fact, about a year and a half ago, EDUCAUSE, which is the umbrella professional organization for information technology in higher ed, launched a very concerted effort that continues quite vigorously through this year to promote the use of data analytics to inform decision making. And I think the short definition of analytics as it's being used here is the capability of asking what-if questions, asking open-ended questions, asking chains of questions, the answers for which are based on data that we've been sitting on the whole time in things like the campus administrative database system. So if the questions, you know, have to do with, just to give a sample, what is it in the profile of students that makes successful art majors or chemistry majors? And what do we know going back into their high school and their family experience? What do we know when we look at graduates and they've gone out into the world? So we take a big, long look at a lot of people from a lot of data points,
mm-hmm.
and what do we discover about that? So that's just one sample, but those are questions you can't answer by going to the standard queries and the standard data reports
yeah.
that, you know, a registrar runs every day or every semester.
Yeah, sure. That's very difficult, I would think, you know, if the analysis is about sort of defining what it means to successfully educate someone, or,
right.
you know, if it comes to you're having to ask what is education and what are we actually doing here? It's not as...
Well, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
You know, as I said in my opening remarks here, I tend to think in terms of questions.
Yeah.
If we can ask the right questions, then we have a chance to move on to the right kinds of answers, to the right ways of reshaping what we do. So I think the toughest thing in data analytics is having a suitably analytic frame of mind.
Yeah.
Being able to not just see what are the surface level questions, the obvious and strategic questions, you know, will we continue to attract enough students? Will they be good students? Will they be able to afford to come here? Can we raise our discount rate in order to preserve our ability to choose and diversify? Those are the obvious questions.
Yeah.
But then taking it into the analytical realm leads you to ask, well, what are the data points, what are the factors that would give us a well-informed response to any one of these questions? So that's why I get very insistent about
yeah.
saying, look, it's all about the question.
And I suppose developing those kinds of questions involves not just one or two people sitting by themselves coming up with the questions, but it would take cooperative dialogue.
Right,
yeah.
right. That's vital. Colleges and universities had for maybe the last 20 or so years had the idea that their Office of Institutional Research
mm-hmm.
would sort of take care of those questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's sort of like thinking that your campus Office of Diversity is going to take care of diversity issues for the whole campus. If you're really going to do anything, everybody's going to roll up sleeves and be involved, and the experts are just going to be that. They're going to be the guides and the teachers, and maybe take the lead in some things. But it really means a whole lot of people. You're exactly right. It has to happen in conversations, and not just when there's a data expert or a computer expert person in the room, but this has to become part of decisions.
So, you know, we should all look forward to meetings, I suppose, which is where this kind of conversation takes place often.
Well, we academics make all kinds of jokes about meetings.
We sometimes
sound a little bit cynical about meetings. but, you know, higher ed, the way colleges and universities work is that lots of people get to participate in governance and in decision making and in doing the groundwork upon which decisions can be based, developing the consensus, etc. And we do that in meetings.
A meeting is
where we talk to each other.
I see it as turning, you know, the adage, know thyself, on the institution, essentially, isn't it?
Exactly. That's a very good way to put it.
It's my perception, and maybe it's local to some extent, maybe it has to do with liberal arts schools, that there isn't as much innovation going on in academic circles as there was back, say, 6, 7, 8 years ago before the recession hit, and there was lots of money, there was lots of grant money floating around, and that computing departments have turned their attention mainly to sort of keeping up the institutional management systems, you know, Banner and those systems, and also the academic systems, the course management systems. Help desks have been made routine, and we have learning commons in the library, but there doesn't seem to be the sort of push for R&D that there was. Now, maybe that was something that was peculiar here to Vassar, you know, a few years back, but I wonder, has the focus of many institutions, anyway, pulled away from innovation and become more utility-oriented?
In a word, yes.
Yes, has it? Yeah.
I would draw out a slightly longer timeline, and again, not to belabor this and take a long time to do it, but I think the heyday, the golden era of innovations, was before the web came about. When the World Wide Web happened, there was a tremendous turning point, tipping point, where previously maybe 20% of the faculty and, you know, with 20% of the students who were the students in their courses were really active and innovative in technology. Everybody else had very minimal interest in it. Maybe just used email and got to the library catalog, you know, through a Telnet connection or something. Then when the web hit, everybody became a computer user, a web user, and that was the time at which we finally got, you know, decent computers out on everybody's desk, faculty and staff. And that's when IT outfits became utility companies and almost had their backs broken just by the weight of going from 20% to 100%.
Oh, I see.
Without any staffing change in most cases, or at least not immediately. Nobody seemed to realize at the time that that was happening, but that's basically when a lot of the innovation went out of the institutional side of IT.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever continued was largely at the initiative of faculty, those who were doing things on their own, and those who were able to get grants. And that did continue until fairly recently. You are correct, I believe, that in the last years, and not just with this recession, but even before that, that sources of federal and philanthropy money for innovation in teaching and you know, in pedagogy and instruction with technology, those were running down. I don't think that looks so interesting. And then I'd skip ahead, though, to say that I actually think that the innovation continues, and it is at least as active as it ever has been, only it's gone underground.
Oh, interesting.
Or it's gone into a gray market because faculty trying things, doing things in their own courses, on their own resources, you know, figuring out how to use Google Maps.
Right.
How to tie that into software, perhaps.
The digital humanities and data-driven science, this is a time when they really seem to be taking hold, so there's something going on.
And in large part, in my opinion, because they're able to use technologies that are either free or cheap and are fairly easy to learn and use. So a lot of these are Web 2.0 technologies, you know, YouTube, sorts of things, yeah. And blogs, all those tools out there that we lump under that title of Web 2.0. And so it's sort of fragmented. A lot of it's happening individually. The central IT unit tends not to know about what's happening out and about on campus. If you ask them to do, and I do this all the time as a consultant, you know, can you tell me what's happening in IT around the curriculum? Or tell me what four yeah. or five or eight faculty are doing. And those are the ones that they've known for a long time or who have come to them for services, but many others don't. I remember finding out several years ago at a college very similar to Vassar that three or four junior French faculty had on their own initiative set up a structured Skype phone call interactions between their students and students in Paris. Mm. These would be structured one-hour sessions, first half in French, second half in English, to benefit the language development of the students on both sides, and around an organized format of conversation and through a pedagogy that the faculty were very thoughtful about. And they didn't have to ask anybody's permission or assistance for this. They didn't need a grant. They didn't need different equipment. And they were just doing it. And I was working in central IT and instructional technology services. We just sort of stumbled across this. We're delighted to find it and to learn about it and to spread the word to others. So I think a lot of it's sort of gone to ground that way because the institution has neither money to offer or lead faculty to, and the central IT folks are just running around trying to keep the lights on. Another thing, very quickly, is I've noticed, really focused on this recently, that even a campus of 2,000 or 3,000 students, Vassar's niche and cohort of liberal arts colleges, has a growing number of little programs and institutes. So there's maybe a center for teaching, a center for experiential learning, over global and international studies. And I think that's where a lot of the innovation and the entrepreneurial efforts of faculty that were sometimes in the past lassoed together under grants to work in IT topics, I think they've found other outlets.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not all technologically dependent or focused, but that's where I think a lot of the work on innovation has moved.
These kinds of things tend to be sort of sporadic.
And they don't talk to each other very much either. When I go around and interview them, people seem surprised that when I ask, well, does a Center for Environmental Studies ever have the opportunity to sit down with folks from the Center for Teaching or one of these others? What do you have in common? Do you have common issues with, you know, problems, common resources, things you might share? And so when I look at, for example, how does Central IT get back into the business that drew most of us old-timers into it, which was the excitement of...
Well, exactly. I was going to ask you about that.
I think, seriously, one thing I'm counseling folks on campuses to look into is, well, can we make a village of all these disparate little siloed operations that are happening? Can we engage at that level and work on a peer level, you know, between IT and among these groups to concentrate on some innovations? Because all this IT stuff is just a waste of money if it doesn't lead to things being done differently and to people thinking differently.
So are there ways to organize people to do this? I visited Carleton about a year ago and was really excited to see what they're doing with their art center. They have a new art center called the White Center that I think it was an old high school or junior high school next to the campus that they moved faculty offices in from various departments, and they set up their dance and arts programs over there, and it's very heavily loaded with technology and IT people. And it really seemed, you know, certainly there was an institutional excitement about the whole endeavor there. People were thinking about teaching and how they could do what they do better, not just about technology.
That's a good observation, and there are a number of other colleges. I think of Occidental and DuPont, just off the top of my head, who have tried similar concentrations. I would lump the Carleton example and the two that I gave into a category that would be of facility-centered, you know, sort of regathering.
There was not centralization quite, because they were satellites, but...
It's putting people in proximity.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
With each other. And that's what people often ask for on campus and respond to favorably. So if you put the people together on a shared space, that's one way to go about it. I think, though, it's also possible, this sort of another avenue to the same objective, is to look at virtual affiliation. So I spoke just a few days ago with a colleague at Smith who works in art history and visual resources and is a librarian by background. And she's been essentially assigned to work part-time, I think something like pretty much half-time, on a project team that involves people from the library and from central IT. And everybody still has their own boss, they have their own office, they have their regular day job. But here's an institution making an experiment to try to create a little virtual group,
mm-hmm.
you know, not forever, not perpetuity, but for a substantial run of time. And the purpose of this is to try to extend the lessons learned in building a digital collection in support of art teaching to history and chemistry and other places around the curriculum. That's another way to look at it. And then what I've also seen on a short-term basis that can be interesting and maybe a good way to explore the interest and turn up the people who might be involved, you know, could be done at a kind of retreat workshop. And I did one of those for a college out in Oregon several years ago where we had maybe 100 people in a big room divided into 8 or 10 or 12 tables and had a mix of people, you know, librarians, IT folks, deans, faculty, a few students mixed in. And, you know, just closed the doors for the afternoon and worked in groups and in plenary on, you know, what are we interested in, where are we going. That was in preparation for a college planning exercise.
Yeah.
But again, everybody commented that they really liked that afternoon, regardless of what would come of it, because it was so unusual for them to be able to sit down and talk with people they don't often get a chance to talk
yeah.
about, and to talk about topics that never come up, it seemed to them, in other settings. So I see that as not an organizational answer to how to get back into the business of supporting innovation, but it can be a chance to discover who's interested and who might be enlisted for, you know, other follow-on sorts of associations.
Sure, and then for the longer term, do you think about sustainability, or is that an issue in the development of programs and projects?
Yeah, you know, I've been working in IT on campuses since 1980, and I would say, looking back over that whole time, the most regrettable phenomenon that covers all those years and so many institutions is our failure to sustain.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And it's often expressed this way. Well, you know, for 3 years we had a grant from Mellon or from Pew or from one of any number of donors, National Science Foundation grants, and interesting things happened, and then the grant was over, and the money and the support went away, and, you know, this faculty member retired, that one didn't get tenure and left, and then it all sort of fell apart. And that's happened over and over and over again.
Yeah. Oftentimes it seems to be not just a matter of money, but personnel. You'll get, you know, program leaders who are really enthusiastic, and then they get a job elsewhere, and
right.
nobody picks up the ball.
Well, you know, this, and circle back very quickly to the analytics that we mentioned
yeah.
before. When I was working at five colleges in Amherst on the project to put together sort of a union catalog of all the courses at the five colleges, and to keep that up, keep that current, one of the things that really hit me between the eyes, something I never expected, and at that point having been higher ed already for about 25 years, was how changeable the course listings are. I wouldn't say the curriculum outlines are pretty much slow
yeah.
moving. The churn in courses, new courses,
yeah.
modified courses, cross listings, is much more active than I think any of us recognized. So if we look at how innovation, you know, is going to happen now, we have to realize that what happens inside the curriculum, that is inside each course, is already quite variable, and it's sustainable, you know, chemistry or French or history are sustainable disciplines because there are certain things that remain important.
Right, there's a certain base of knowledge.
Base of knowledge. Yeah. Now, I'll say, but if you're looking at just particular techniques or pedagogies, they tend to come and go anyway in all the rest of what happens in the curriculum. But here, let me give you a counterexample of some instances where IT did become very sustainable. And these go back to Bryn Mawr College in the 1980s. And this was a trend that was underway already when I arrived there in 1986 and continued very strongly. It was something that I was very impressed with and did everything I could to support. And it went like this. Several academic departments, on their own volition, internally on their own thinking, for their own reasons, made long-term commitments on IT-related questions. So, for example, the math department decided that they were going to use that Mathematica software in every single course from then on, and that all the faculty would be competent in it and every student would. They saw that as an important thing to do because they thought it was an effective contributor to getting more women students over the math barrier.
Yeah.
And that's why they liked the Mathematica program. And again, Bryn Mawr Laboratory Sciences. One year, they all got together and said, listen, we're going to teach all our students how to use Excel spreadsheets and to do graphs from them as part of their normal lab work, and we're going to teach them that in the first week of every 101 course.
Mm-hmm.
And then, last example, already when I arrived in 1985, the sociology department was using SPSS in all of its courses, and every SOC student taking whatever the 101 course was, they all learned it right then and there.
Yeah.
And to this day, that is very unusual. You just don't see that. You see a professor or two or three using Mathematica in the math department, and others don't.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of left. So the difference is when there's a departmental decision and commitment, it has some durability.
Mm-hmm.
When you say, well, you know, we all do our own thing, and we all choose our own pedagogy, and, you know, do whatever you think is appropriate, I think that's more the rule. But
yeah.
When a department comes to that tipping point, then I think that's, in my experience, one of the most effective ways of thinking, that IT-related supports for learning are sustained.
Yeah, there is more collaborative course planning going on for introductory courses now than there used to be, it seems.
I think so.
Yeah.
There was an interesting talk that Alan Kay, who was, he's a computing old-timer, he's essentially the person who invented the concept of the mouse and of the what you see, you know, the visual graphical interface that we all use.
WYSIWYG, yeah.
Computers and WYSIWYG and on tablets. So his name is Alan Kay, and he developed these back in the days of the Palo Alto Research Center, PARC, which is sort of legendary in computer history. And he gave a really interesting talk last year at the annual summit meeting of the National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education, NITLE. And his argument in a sentence or two was this. He said, listen, systems, the study of systems should be viewed as a liberal art, and the language of systems study is computing. And what he was talking about was bridging silos, breaking down silo boundaries. And he used things such as the connections that have developed and are now quite standard between biology and computer science.
We just had a discussion with Professor John Long last week about his use of robots to study concepts in paleobiology.
I think Kay is onto something here, because we see from other perspectives, as you noted, that a lot of the interesting innovations coming in the academic disciplines are coming where the disciplines are reaching out over the traditional boundary to each other. And Kay's argument was that, you know, if we take a look at some of the methodological fundamentals that go along with that work, we keep circling back to technology. And yet in the liberal arts setting, we tend to be a little bit wary. You know, we can tolerate maybe a computer science program on campus as long as it's closer to math than it is to real engineering.
But there is now, especially with younger scholars in the humanities, certainly this excitement about digital humanities and sort of data-driven projects that are by nature collaborative and that trans-institutional often also. So, of course, how these fit into the peer review and tenure process, nobody quite knows yet. But
well, that's always been a challenge. You know, technology doesn't bring that up for the first time.
No.
But I think it's safe to say that anybody who diverges from the traditional topics and methods in a discipline is running a higher risk of being reviewed negatively, because our institutions go out to the established scholars, and there's a kind of conservatism comes with that approach.
That's almost a law, I think, of the academy. I've lived in it long enough myself that it is a ship that is very hard to get it to change course in any significant way.
One thing I've heard over many years is this notion that a new category should be added to the tenure criteria.
Mm-hmm.
So, the holy triad there has always been teaching, research, and service. And there's a line of argument that goes back many years saying, well, engagement with technology, thoughtful engagement with technology ought to be a fourth category. And I personally have always disagreed with that, because I believe that if the engagement with technology is worthwhile, it's going to change teaching, it's going to change research, and the benefits should show. So if you're doing something very different in your classroom, it should be reflected in the kinds of assessments of what you do in the classroom.
Yeah, and people tend to forget that technology is technology when it's been used a long time. I mean, all the apparatus, the scholarly apparatus that goes into producing any kind of printed product, a book, whatever, requires a tremendous amount of learning over the years, starting when you're an undergraduate, learning how to do footnotes and bibliography. There's a whole protocol for doing a book so that people know when they, open the book, there's going to be a contents and possibly an index in the back. And certainly, we're already technologically adept in many ways and don't seem to know it sometimes, I think.
Right. I've forgotten who formulated this, but when a technology is new, it looks like magic.
Yeah.
I guess I'd say the flip side of that is when the technology gets well settled, it becomes invisible.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't think of it. You're right. We don't think of a ballpoint pen as technology. We don't think of our, doorknob as technology.
No.
But it is. We use these things all the time, and they're invisible to us as tools. We just pick them up and use them.
The big question on everybody's mind now is, of course, how are the very traditional technologies of higher education, which are the lecture hall and the seminar room and a library, they're spaces, but they're technologies of a kind. Are they going to give way, do you think, with the onset of online courses?
No, I emphatically do not think so. I think, and I see as I look around, I see bricks and mortar institutions building, expanding, and not just the wealthiest of them. I see the hunger for people to get degrees changing. What has changed radically is that fewer and fewer people do a four-year degree from ages 18 to 22. Lifelong learning is no longer just a catchword. People really do find that they're continually going back to school. So I think the demand is there. We've heard there's been a softening of demand and enrollment, and the public is losing faith in the value of a degree. I think that's not true. I think there's plenty of evidence for it. But to get to your point, I think the most effective education still happens in the lecture hall and in the seminar room and in the library. What we have been distracted by in recent years has been the new to us discovery about the extent and importance of informal learning, the kinds of things that students get together and do spontaneously. And that's nice to notice that, but if we take a look at, for example, one of my favorite online information sources, the TED Talks.
Yeah.
Was it Technology, Entertainment, and Design?
It's a wonderful site.
But those are lectures. Those are platinum quality lectures.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And that's what they are.
Yeah.
And they're thrilling. And again, I just don't want to get into a rhapsody here, but I think there's nothing as effective as an excellent lecture.
Well, you wonder then if technology can make the lecture, which, a lot of people were starting to feel, it wasn't an efficient way to communicate information. There are other things that go on there apart from,
I would say that what comes across in a lecture really has never been the information, but the way the lecturer models a thinking process and models an interaction, himself or herself, with the topic.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that is what is witnessed. But I'm getting down to a kind of quibble there, and that's just my opinion. But if we think of it this way, if we take a look at the MOOCs, we take a,
massively online
classes, And there is a TED Talk on this by one of the co-founders. I can't remember her name at the moment. One of the co-founders of Coursera.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful talk out there. And she says, you know, imagine or reimagine that your students have a choice of maybe 4 or 5 lectures on, you know, for topic Q in the sequence in a syllabus. And maybe one of those is yours and the others are that of other faculty. So it's not, as we often hear, that none of us will do lectures because, you know, one physicist who does the best lecture in the world on whatever topic, everybody's going to watch that lecture.
Yeah.
Now, there's another model, which is, you know, what if students could take their pick of watching, you know, one or more of several lectures on a topic? There's an increased richness and diversity, but still a place of honor for the lecture. Now, that may not happen in the classroom.
Yeah.
You may switch that out, or flip, as they've been saying in recent years. You may flip the classroom, and that lecture, both yours and those others, is delivered, you know, as a video. And then what you spend an hour on, instead of you doing your lecture as the professor, is you go on to what would normally be the homework and work with students to discuss it, break it down, do whatever.
These massively online courses are trans-institutional. Anyone can log on and watch them. And there is talk, certainly in academic circles and in intellectual technology circles, about the possibilities. Well, the possibilities have been there for some time, but there's more and more perceived need for trans-institutional cooperation all over the place in administrative systems as well as academic systems. And that's partly what, as I say, digital humanities is about. And sciences have been traditionally a little bit about this, certainly. And I wonder if there's a role for IT organizations to play here, or is this something that needs to be fostered?
Sure. I think IT organizations are well situated to play a role if, in fact, these collaborations become substantial and sustained, because to make that geography-spanning cooperation possible, that's sort of a definition of why you have a network. So the importance of network goes way up. The importance of storing things in spaces that are accessible to people across institutional boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, federated storage.
Yeah. Yeah, and libraries, cooperative collection development.
Yeah.
You know, and libraries are really pushing ahead.
Of nice topics. I'm a little bit skeptical about the prospects for sustained collaboration that way, because when I worked at the consortium of colleges, 5 colleges consortium in Amherst, one of the things I noticed there was that, and looking out at other consortia, is that even when there's a strong commitment and a genuine, sincere wish to cooperate, the institutional behavior is very tough to cope with. And one of its primary expressions is that these institutions keep their best resources, their people and their money, for those projects that they consider core and strategic. And they tend to cooperate on projects where the priority is lower and the value is lower. So I think that's what we're seeing now.
Yeah.
So when you get MIT, well, MIT is a case in itself, but you get, you know, Harvard, Stanford, these other places, all of whom have tried in the past to launch online education, all have failed. Columbia also had failed at it. Harvard failed at it. Now they've gotten the excitement about the MOOCs. They're coming back to this concept. But let's see what they actually do other than to pool the results or to pool the offerings that they bring out there. Will they actually co-develop things? You know, that remains to be seen, and I've not seen that happen even in much more tightly focused consortia.
Yeah, it has to do just, I suppose, as we were talking, the basic conservatism of the institution.
Colleges can't take risky ventures. They can't afford to fail.
Yeah. And then
things that will threaten their ability to stay in business.
Yeah.
And so they are naturally very, very conservative that way, and they would really be irresponsible not to be conservative.
Yeah.
As a lawyer once told me, you have to think of a college or a university, and particularly private ones, as being more akin to a trust fund than a corporation. So not to lose resources, not to jeopardize the continuity of the enterprise, those are the things that every president thinks when he or she first gets out of bed in the morning. They don't think, I can go out and bet the farm on some new thing. You notice that nobody is.
None of these
institutions is giving academic credit for these MOOCs. You know, and there are plenty of institutions that, of course, do give credit for, you know, for online learning, and that's a very, very different model.
Yeah, maybe if the economy changes, we'll start thinking of ourselves more, again, as educational institutions and less as trust funds. But
I think that could, in fact, help us stay on our course. In my time in higher ed, I haven't seen a bigger panic than since last May. In fact, you can go back to the day, I think it was May 4th. David Brooks' op-ed article in the New York Times on the coming tsunami, which the term he picked up, and he freely admitted this in his article, is from Ken Auletta, I think the New Yorker. And that sent off shockwave that was heard in every boardroom. And, well, see what happened or nearly happened in University of Virginia. Minor crises are happening in almost every
all industry. Over the place. Yeah, that David Brooks is a troublemaker. So.
Well, I went, you know, I surprised myself. I went back and reread that article a couple of days ago, and I think he's actually right. However, the implications are, you know, as he freely admitted, are yet to be understood.
Yeah, well, certainly the costs of higher education.
Happening, I think, is we've been hearing for a long time that things can't continue as they are. Prices go up faster than cost of living. You know, I've been hearing this, the sky is falling is what we've been hearing. But the jumps in logic go like this. They say things are changing. Well, yeah, they're always changing, and yeah, they're not changing. The big brand name places are making some splashy moves. And then, as Brooks said, every substantial institution ought to have an online presence, ought to be able to do this. So you put that link in the so-called thinking, and then you start asking, well, what are we doing on our campuses to participate in setting up an online curriculum and such? And so you get this sort of falling of dominoes that way, and I think those are wrong questions. And as I said before, I'm all about advocating for right questions.
Two questions I have yet. One is, I wonder about personnel and with the changes that are taking place in the environment. Our chief information officers, our chief technology officers, are different things required of them now than have been in the past?
The nature of the CIO job has, in fact, changed very substantially.
Yeah.
And parenthetically, I'd say that even the term chief information officer, I don't know when that really settled in. I think it was sometime in the 90s. So it was only sort of halfway through the lifespan of, you know, electronic technology on campus. We even focused on that. But even since that time, it's changed. And here's how it's changed. The term these days really, as one of my colleagues put it, should be understood to mean chief integration officer. And it's not just the integration of technology, but the integration of program, interests, constituencies, clientele, and that's where the work is. So now the CIO has to be a diplomat, has to be a persuader, has to be campus citizen at a high level, on top of all the existing job requirements, which were to understand technology, to have some clear vision on technology, and to be able to manage and support the people who make that technology work. You don't have to have a computer science degree, any particular degree, to accomplish that any more than you need to be a pilot to be president of an airline.
Yeah.
Or to be a surgeon, to be the president of a hospital. And in fact, that latter comparison is one I use often, is that, you know, your CIO has to have sort of the same skills portfolio as the president of a hospital. Has to understand, you know, what anesthesiologists are talking about and what their issues are, and nursing and pharmacy and social care and finance and staff recruitment and retention. And I'd say maybe bit different, especially in the academic side, is the ability to be effective in the shared governance ethic, which means, you know, you've got to know firsthand most of the faculty. You can't just sit back in an office and just stay inside the tech shop anymore and be effective. And that's been hard. There's no obvious background. There's no standard background or path of preparation. So that really complicates the search process.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Do we have to hire somebody from a school that looks like us? Can we hire a CIO from an insurance company or a bank? These are very tough questions.
I would guess so. You'd have to know something about management, of course, and then something also about the institutional culture of the institution you're going to. So, so when you arrive on a campus as a consultant, do you have an idea in your head of the sort of ideal liberal arts setup, or are institutions just so different that you really have to take each one completely new?
Well, my stock answer to that, and I'll give you that just so I can get beyond it.
Okay.
You know, it's a quote Leo Tolstoy said, happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. So, yes, success tends to look the same everywhere. Mm-hmm. So if a campus has a really good IT help desk, it always looks pretty much the same. You walk up to it, and what you see and what you hear and what people around campus say doesn't vary from place to place.
Yeah.
But every time there are problems on help desk or any other of the little subtopics that add up to the IT scene, there's always, well, you got to understand, you know, here's the local history and here's how we got this way. And, you know, and those are always different. So when I arrive on campus, you know, again, I'll go sort of metaphorical again here. You know, think about what happens when you walk into a doctor's office, your general practitioner. And that person sort of looks you over, makes an assessment, can see various things physically, you know, physical observation, can tell things from what you're saying, how you talk, you know, how you're carrying yourself. So you start the diagnosis right away.
Yeah.
That's always cranked into high gear even before I get to campus. And so, yes, I'm running a complex kind of heuristic exercise, high energy and intensity, that presumes that I know the difference between healthy and unhealthy. And the healthy, as I said, on the Tolstoy metaphor or comparison here, tends to be pretty easy to, I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
In other words, people say, oh, yes, they do a good job at this, or I don't have any issues with that. Or you can see, for example, if there are people walking up to the help desk, if the phone is ringing constantly, those are signs of health.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a student sitting there doing homework and you notice that for 10, 15 minutes there isn't a phone call or anything coming up on the email, well, then that's a help desk that is probably so dysfunctional that everybody goes around it. So I would say that the hallmarks of an ideal IT operation at a liberal arts college are that it's comfortably and visibly well aligned with the campus spirit, culture, purposes. It doesn't look and feel and act like something different.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. The staff show up at cultural and social events on campus and mix and mingle easily. That there's a lot of independent capability around campus. So, for example, it's always a positive diagnostic sign when I can see that there is sort of a lead IT user in each administrative office and that person is the hub of questions and knowledge and solutions at the office level and has a good relationship with IT. So that happens on every single campus of any size or kind that's doing IT, right? So, you know, just to grab on, you know, the first couple of things that come to mind, those are examples of how a highly functional and effective organization looks. It's quiet, it hums, it's ubiquitous, it's well-regarded. It's an outfit that is viewed as a friend and an ally and a source of guidance and encouragement.
Interesting. So generally, is morale an indicator?
That again is one of the things I look for. Just as you know, your general practitioner is going to look at your affect.
Yeah.
And maybe not make deep conclusions from it, but at least get cues.
Yeah.
And so the if the morale is not good, you've really got to find out what's the matter. And it's often not one thing or something recent. It tends to be an accumulation. You know, one of the characteristics of all of us who work on campuses is we tend to hang in there a lot longer and in much tougher circumstances than people out in the commercial world.
Yeah, that's true.
And so sometimes we get the you know, you get the boiled frog syndrome. I think I can stand it a little longer. I can stand it a little longer, and then all of a sudden it's a crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
And if that crisis manifests itself as, you know, some kind of rupture or noticeably poor morale, then I think there's some real digging to do to find what that is.
Yeah,
and
sure.
It's often not just a mood or something that will...
Yeah, it's probably structural, I would guess.
It's usually a structural or... Yeah. You know, deep organic cause or complex of causes more often.
Yeah.
I would say, I just, you know, to put in one last thought that I think we didn't really come to squarely is to be thinking on campus about how, you know, it's not about technology. Technology is, by definition, the tools that people make up to do things of value for themselves and for others. So where is the line where once we've crossed it, we don't view technology? And, you know, by the way, anybody born digital, in other words, anybody under the age of 30, has much less problem with this concept than the rest of us.
Yeah.
Is they don't think about technology as being special or apart. It's like asking somebody, did you go online today?
Yeah.
I mean, try asking that question out and about on campus.
Yeah.
So when the institutions can evolve to the place that their students and junior faculty already are, which is, hey, look, this is part of life. It's part of what we do. It's here to stay. It's important, but we're not going to obsess about it. So I think if we can identify how to get our institutions across that same divide, short of waiting for the day when they're run by people from that generation, I think that would be much healthier.
Oh, great. So I want to thank you, Tom, for joining us today on the Library Cafe to talk about academic computing.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Tom. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been very nice. We've been talking today with Thomas Warger, a leading academic computing consultant, about trends and issues in academic computing. You're listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie.